From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made tomorrow when Rochester City Council will vote on whether to reauthorize a tax break that its critics say has overinflated luxury apartments downtown. It's not a sexy name of legislation. It's called 485A. It's designed to spur new development, especially downtown. Mayor-elect Malik Evans said on Connections on Friday that he had problems with 485A in the past, but it has been amended and improved. And Evans says it's vital to have affordable housing tied to any luxury development. But the critics don't believe it's changed enough. They argue that this is a piece of legislation that has offered massive tax breaks for many years to luxury developers, all while smaller developers get nothing. And our guests are here to talk about maybe the impacts and how they perceive it, how they perhaps perceive the criticism or misunderstandings. Let's talk about it. In studio with us is Matt Druin, who is a partner at Oak Grove Development. Matt, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what Oak Grove does.
So Oak Grove, we specialize in historic adaptive reuse projects. A lot of what we've been focused on lately has been purchasing vacant historic buildings and breathing new life in them. But my background comes from all sort of aspects of development, from multifamily to student housing, hotels, retail, the whole sort of spectrum.
Very good. On the line with us is Joe Hanna, who is the owner of Hanna Properties, president of the Southeast Landlord Coalition. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And Riddhi Singh is with us, communications coordinator with the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester. Hi, Riddhi.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'd like to start just by asking all three of our guests to describe how they see 485. And again, I want to tell listeners, usually I'm not quite this blunt. Don't tune out because it's a boring name. This is an important conversation about how we choose to develop the city, what incentives are there, whether they are working, and whether they should be changed here. And City Council's got an important decision tomorrow. Riddhi, how do you see this? How do you explain what 485A is, how it works?
So 485A is a tax break given to developers. And essentially what developers use it for is to develop luxury, market rate housing. And when we subsidize high rent housing with 485A, we end up driving up rents for everybody. And we also shift the burden to pay for those tax breaks onto working class homeowners. Even with these changes that Mayor-elect Evans talked about last week, we're still subsidizing 80% high rent housing and driving displacement in our community.
Joe Hanna, how do you see it?
I see it a little differently. If my understanding is, that, as I read this legislation, that the tax break or incentive is only applies to the increased assessment. So if Building X is currently assessed at $1 million, and the incentive, because of the incentive, the developer is willing to spend $2 million to turn it into luxury apartments, the tax on the $1 million still stays in place, and it's the abatement that lasts for 8 years, and then, or the increase that's abated that lasts for the 13 years. Is that correct?
That is correct as I read it. Riddhi, do you read it any differently?
Yeah. So it's 45A is usually given to conversions. It always is given to conversions, so it's not residential before.
Right.
And then it becomes mixed use, and it's been used in Center City to develop luxury housing.
Okay, but to Joe's point, if the building X is assessed at Y, you're still going to pay the tax up to Y, but if you then develop it and, say, you put in luxury apartments and it doubles in its assessment, you're not paying on that new 100% jump for 8 years, and then after 8 years, it's kind of a sunset of that break on that. Is that right, Riddhi?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so Joe's roughly correct here, and Matt Druin as partner at Oak Grove Development, how do you see 485A?
I see it as essential in the renaissance of our city. I mean, we've experienced decades of disinvestment that was as a result of racist housing policies, as a result of Federal Housing Administration and the federal government. And this is a way to reverse that and bring back higher income people into our urban areas that bring disposable income that support our essential services and also support our tax base as well.
Okay. Do you dispute the idea that this is, at its core, a tax break for more luxury housing?
I have to laugh for a second. What's identified as luxury housing in downtown Rochester is not luxury housing. You know, new floors, new kitchens, and granite countertops, stainless steel appliances is not luxury housing. You see in larger cities like New York City, San Francisco, luxury housing that's extremely amenity rich with swimming pools, concierge service at the desk. I mean, these are essentially just new apartments that are appealing to higher income earners. I do not think that they are luxury apartments, but call that as you will.
Well, you think we're using that term too broadly, luxury?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It makes my skin crawl every time I hear it is received as luxury housing. So,
if I can just respond.
Go ahead, Rudy. Yep.
Yeah. So an example of what I'm talking about when I'm saying luxury housing. So the Metropolitan, which is 1 South Clinton Ave, developer Andy Galina, by the time this tax break is done, will have received $6 million in tax breaks. And the apartments in that building, he charges as much as $3,650 for a 2-bedroom. So if that's not luxury housing, I'm kind of confused, because if you talk to the average Rochesterian, they cannot afford $3,650 for a 2-bedroom.
What do you think, Matt?
It's not very popular, but we need higher income earners in our city. I mean, if you look at our landscape, we've suffered from poverty, and how we reverse that and reverse structural racism is by blending incomes and people from diverse backgrounds. And we're seeing people move back into the city. And the thing is that I don't have a problem with this program because, one, it actually incentivizes developers to convert office to housing, which would be housing units that wouldn't normally exist. I own office buildings in downtown Rochester, and I can't give space away. Okay. And this is the only.
Is that pandemic specific or is that pre-pandemic as well?
Oh, it's always been challenging. But post-pandemic has been absolutely, it's been absolutely devastating. So my point is that any new housing units that don't displace people is good housing. So that's why I'm supportive of this program. There's also 30 West Broad Street, Rochester Historic City Hall. A developer was considering repositioning that into 100% office, like higher end office space. Well, they found out about the Q program, which if they convert more than 30% of their floor plates to housing, that they can receive a pretty generous tax abatement over the life of that that program. And so, and generally, these higher income apartments are people that don't have, they're not net users of public services. They don't depend upon public services that much, so they're not a drag on that. They don't send kids to school. So it broadens the tax base within which to provide those services for less fortunate, low to moderate income people.
All right, let me ask our other guests to respond, and then I want to hear what Malik Evans, the mayor-elect, had to say about this on Friday. Rudy Singh, I'll let you start, and then I'll get Joe here. What do you make of what you just heard from Matt?
I think we agree on some basic principles. So we want a thriving downtown. We want to see the revitalization in our city, but we want that to be for everybody. If we're going to be using policy, if we're going to be giving out tax breaks, we want to make a downtown for people of all incomes. That is not what 485A is. So we want to create housing that's affordable for people of all income levels and has basic tenant protections built in for everyone. And I want to dispute the idea that this is not going to create, or that this hasn't resulted in displacement. So as mentioned earlier, when we build more luxury housing, when we build high rent housing, that drives up what's market rate, that drives up rents in the immediate areas around and also just in the city in general. And then it does the second piece that is really crucial when we're talking about the impact. It increases property taxes for ordinary property owners throughout the city. So when we give out these big tax breaks, we have to make up for that lost tax revenue. What the city has done traditionally is try to make up for it through really aggressive property like reassessments. So it's not only increasing rent for renters, it's increasing taxes for landlords, and especially for working class homeowners. We've got this huge issue with a lack of black homeownership in our city. This is going to make it more difficult for the folks who do have homes, who have been able to purchase their homes, to afford to stay there because they can't pay for their taxes.
Okay, let me get Johanna, and then there's a couple of follow-ups that come to mind, but let me get Joe's thoughts on that. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, well, my thoughts are we should back up a little bit. I've been in the housing business for Rochester for 51 years, and over my period have developed, converted, rehabbed over 600 apartments, none of which are downtown, none of which I received a tax break. We live in a county with a very static population. So where are the studies that show that, A, there is a need for this, and secondly, my concern as a landlord whose properties are in the Park Ave at NOTA East Ave area, and the members of our group are in that same area in the South Wedge as well, is what happens when if these apartments from downtown start draining our rental pool at the upper end of our tenancy. That is my concern.
Okay. So let me follow up with Riddy, and then I've got a follow-up for Matt. So Riddy, when you say that these tax breaks, which sometimes go to luxury development, as you describe it, Matt disputes that term, but the term is the term right now, when you say that, hey, you got these luxury tax breaks, and as a result, other taxpayers, we've got to fill the gap because the developer has this sweet deal. I guess the question that comes to mind is, if you take a building that's empty and nothing's happening there, and then all of a sudden something thriving is happening there, but for the first 8 years, there is a break on the taxes, the argument I think that Matt or others may make is, it's not that the average taxpayer's got to pick up the slack because that developer got a deal. It's that that developer created something that was nothing was happening there and added something thriving and will eventually pay a full tax bill. But to get it on the ground, to go from zero to 60 perhaps, needed a little break there. So there was no tax. There wasn't much in taxes coming in. There isn't anything to make up for. They're creating something out of nothing. How do you see that?
Let's take a step back, because there's like this underlying assumption I'm kind of hearing in this conversation from maybe you and definitely from Matt, that this development wouldn't happen without these tax breaks. But these developments are actually profitable without the tax breaks. So to go back to the Metropolitan, the property value, it increased in $17 million. Andy Galina, as an investor, is seeing an increase of $17 million. He's gotten tax breaks worth $6 million. So if he did have to pay those, that's still a rise of equity of $11 million that he's getting. So it is extremely profitable already. On top of that, he's renting out the units in that property. So let's go back to the number, $3,650 for a two-bedroom that he's charging on a monthly basis. That is a pretty impressive profit to me. So, I mean, we're talking about it as if they don't get these tax breaks, they lose money. That's simply not the case. Even without these tax breaks, developers make a large amount of money on these kinds of developments.
No, you see, that was exactly my follow-up for Matt. I wanted to ask you, you said you own offices downtown, you can't give them away, and if you turn them into housing, all of a sudden, that is a benefit for a city that wants to attract more people, wants to thrive and grow. Why do you need a tax break? Why don't you just do it?
Because it doesn't pencil out financially. I've been involved with development projects prior to myself being independent, where we depended upon those tax breaks that we're talking about today in order for a project to even happen. If the program didn't, and what we're dealing with right now is we're dealing with confirmation bias, right? We see a successful project and we're like, oh, look at how much money this guy made. And, you know, look at how expensive these apartments are. Who can afford that? Well, you don't consider all those projects that did not happen, and they continue not to happen on all the vacant properties. I mean, we own properties in the Four Corners area. I mean, I can't tell you how many vacant buildings there are around that area. So what we need to consider here is that Rochester, and this is another controversial thing, is that Rochester does not suffer from a cost of housing problem. It suffers from an income problem. So let's focus on policy orientation that rises incomes, because you see these things. It's like it's complete. It kind of blows your mind in terms of makes you confused, because you see things about how housing is so affordable in Rochester, and then you have this affordable housing crisis that we have. And how do you reconcile those two things? its income side. Now, to piggyback on what I said is that with the Q program, for instance, which is a pretty generous tax abatement program, I'm all for tying a certain percentage of units that are a certain percentage of AMI with that program, because it's actually a more generous than the typical pilot program. And then what the city can offer, because this all comes down to property valuations. If we can't get a value on the back end that makes the project make sense from a financial standpoint, then we need to seek subsidies in order for that. So a lot of affordable housing developers like Home Leasing and Rochester Cornerstone Development depend upon dollars from Homes Community Renewal that will help provide gap financing for those projects. So offer a incentive to developers to add a certain amount of units that are a certain percentage of AMI. And then if the numbers don't work in the back end, provide home dollars to make that happen.
Okay, so what you're saying is on the front end, there's a big number of these projects wouldn't happen at all without this break. That's what you're saying?
That is absolutely correct.
Why not have a provision that says, hey, you're going to get this break, but if this turns into a successful deal, down the line, you got to pay those taxes back.
I mean, this is the thing, is that if you understand risk, there's an enormous amount of risk involved with development. Everybody thinks that, oh, this is a slam dunk. We're going to put these luxury apartments up downtown, and then...
No, I'm saying it's not a slam dunk. I'm saying if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You can keep the break. It didn't work out. But if it works, if it's a big success, then we do need you to pay back the taxes.
I mean, I think if somebody takes risks, then they should be rewarded. I don't think that would provide... That would create a enormous amount of compliance, and then clawing back that because your project was so wildly successful. What it does is it provides, oh, look, Andy Galina made a ton of money on this project. Let's do this too, provide more units. And then if you have a program that's more equitable in terms of having a certain percentage of units that, you know, and we're talking about mixed income properties here. I think that we need more mixed income projects, especially downtown, because, you know, otherwise you have affordable housing developers that create these huge towers where you have a bunch of low-income people that are siloed together. How are we supposed to break down these barriers without that? So that's something that I do support, is having a certain amount of units that are tied to a certain percentage of AMI.
We're going to hit that in just a second, because that's what Mayor-elect Evans talked about. But let me just ask Joe and Riddy if they want to respond, and then you're going to hear from Malik Evans. Go ahead, Johanna. What do you make of this?
I would agree with Matt wholeheartedly. I've spent a lot of years on affordable housing boards, and there are the need in this city. There are thousands of our fellow citizens who don't have access to safe, affordable housing. And they should, at a minimum, these projects should be an 80-20, which I believe Charlotte Square is and has been successful. And this would address some of our lower income citizens' need for affordable housing. And I think Reedy would probably agree.
All right, Reedy, go ahead.
Yeah, so I want to take, I know I keep talking about steps back, but I've got another one. So 45A is a policy that was designed by the state, right? So this isn't something that the city created. This is a policy that was created, I want to say, early 2000s, that we decided to opt into in 2003. And we've decided over and over again since 2003 to opt into. So, I think there's room for experimenting with policy and trying different things out. But this is just, you know, we didn't set up 45A. Our city didn't set up 45A. This was created by state legislators. And there's another kind of interesting piece about 45A, which is that it's actually given after the conversion. So it's not like a tax break that comes before when you're trying to figure out how to pay for the development, when you're kind of in that process. It's after the development, you can apply for 45A and then receive it. So it doesn't really operate as an incentive as the same way as other things. And then just lastly, I want to just remind everybody that investment is a risk. Investment is always a risk. And we can't, we can't develop policy that's like kind of ignoring that. I hear this really often from housing investors that are hoping to get, just a guarantee on their investment consistently. But, the housing market is volatile. This is not like this is not a system where you put something in and you're automatically going to get something back. We can't cater to investors in that way.
I think Matt's just saying that you're going to have fewer people willing to take risks at all then.
Yeah, I understand that, but I think, you know, I think it's really not a lot of these investors, not everybody, but the majority of investors who invest in housing in our community, they don't live in our community. And then we create city policy that is designed to cater to these people who the majority are white men who live outside of the city bounds. So what we're essentially doing is we're passing control of our community on to these outside investors. So what we really want to see, we want to get creative. We want to figure out new policies that we can implement that allow for increased community control, increased community input, and increased development, but without displacement.
Well, one of the things that Mayor-elect Evans pointed to in our recent conversation about this is a change in provisions that he says will make it more equitable and will pull more people from mixed incomes together. He says that hasn't always been the case, but this is him on the program on Friday essentially defending this new version of 485A.
Well, first off, 485-A, we just amended it, which I think it was huge, and we amended it because individuals spoke out about it. The original 485-A, I had serious problems with, but we amended that program, and council, and one of the things we did was the program was modified now to require community benefits as for 20%. Of the total number of residential units, they must be affordable to households earning at or below 60% of the area median income. The projects are also subject now to the city's minority women-owned business enterprises and workforce goals. So I heard loud and clear that people wanted that modified, and we did that. And that's important because we need to have a housing policy that reflects. If you look at what they did in, if you look at Montgomery County, Prince George's County, whenever people have built these new apartments or nice apartments, they have to make sure that they have affordable housing attached to it. And I think that that's what we need to be able to do in Rochester. You know, the one thing that concerns me in Rochester sometimes is that people think that people who might be lower income should not live in quote unquote nice places. And we need to turn that on its head. They absolutely need to. And one of the examples we have is if you look at the apartments that are by Spot Coffee, some of those folks are working class, and then some of them are higher level professionals, and you would not know the difference. And that's important if we're going to talk about changing our school system, and if we're going to talk about not just building housing that has people all of the same income.
That is City Council Member Malik Evans, Mayor-elect Malik Evans, on the program on Friday. Sounds to me like he is going to vote in favor of 485A. I'll let our guests weigh in on that, and then we're going to take some of your phone calls. Riddhi Singh, first, what did you hear from the mayor there? He's not the mayor yet, the mayor-elect.
Yeah, so there's two pieces. One's a little bit more complicated, so I'll start out with just talking about the minority women-owned businesses. We think this is a really strong positive, and all development in Rochester should have policies like this, maybe even stronger. But it would be really ironic if the people who build these new developments, if we had more minorities, more women workers and businesses involved, it would be very ironic if they would be unable to afford to live in these developments. And it would be extremely ironic if they are actually displaced from their homes so they can no longer afford property taxes or rent because they participated and helped build these new developments. The second piece, so, you know, we hear AMI thrown around a lot when we talk about development. So let's break down what that means. So area median income is a number that's the median income for all of the county. That's not just the city of Rochester. So the area median income, I believe, in Monroe County is about $56,000. Now, the area median income in the city of Rochester is $22,000. So we're calculating the supposed affordability for projects in the city of Rochester based on like this county median income, which is double what's going on in the city. So we ran some calculations ourselves about what rent would look like with 60% AMI. So again, this is based on county figures. It's about $900 just for a studio. And again, if we're saying median income, this is true for Rochester residents, is $22,000. How is someone who's making $22,000 a year going to afford a $900 studio? That's about half of their income. So this is not really truly affordable. we want to, you know, I agree with what folks have been saying, having mixed income developments could be really positive, and that we should have more mixed income neighborhoods. But I think we gotta, like, I think we have to look more about what we're saying, look at the numbers, kind of behind the numbers. We, instead of just throwing around some of this technical language, make it really clear. Because once we get clear, we see it's not truly affordable.
Johanna, do you see it that way?
No. One, the $900 is the average price of a studio is not correct. And we see these inflated figures on what rents are. I have, I don't know, 200, 250 studios, and the average rent on those are in the 700 range, around 750. So we have to be careful with the numbers we throw around. The other thing I'd like to ask Drew and Matt, which really isn't off topic, my years of experiencing and witnessing downtown and development by Bob Morgan, Andy, and others, is one of the justifications for downtown development is that we need people downtown, living downtown, to have a viable inner city, or, and I use inner city, central city is a better word. And is this a justifiable to the point that we provide luxury housing, as Riddy pointed out?
Matt, what do you think?
I mean, I'm going to go back to my point in terms of working for a development company, actually running the numbers on some of these development projects that we did or did not do, and they wouldn't have happened without this program. So I'm going to go back to that. And also to kind of piggyback on that as well, I mean, one of the reasons why, you know, Joe, you're opposed to the luxury housing tax break in terms of it siphoning residents, you know, prospective residents to downtown, you know, more expensive apartments, I think is a good thing. I mean, what I've been seeing is that I own most of my properties are in the same areas where you own properties. And I've seen my incomes from prospective residents for a $900, $800 one-bedroom apartment go from $75,000 to $100,000 a year applicant, where I've been seeing the incomes go down for those applicants. So I've been seeing a more of a mixing of low to moderate income people that are able to have access to housing in the Southeast area, which adds to the mixing of that. So when you increase supply, which we need, we desperately need supply, we need all the tools in the tool belt from this program that we're debating today, as well as affordable low-income housing tax credits, to any type of tools we can to work on the supply side of things. Through the policies that we passed with the HSTPA of 2019 and the endless eviction moratorium is that we're hurting supply and we need more of it. So, because the only way you can actually bring prices down or moderate prices over time is by increasing supplies. So that's why I support it.
Do you?
Well, to be clear.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Reddy. Yep.
That's not the only way to moderate rental prices. We can also opt into rent stabilization and other policies. And I know Matt said earlier that the problem, you know, is just that, you know, that we don't have the wages aren't increasing. Wages are stagnating while rents are also increasing. It's happening at the same time. We have to address both issues at once. So we have to find ways to stop rent from skyrocketing, which it has even during the pandemic, while we also find ways of helping to increase the minimum wage, for example. But if we do just one, it's not going to solve the whole problem.
I disagree that, excuse me, that rents are skyrocketing. My rent increases, the number of units I have over 2 years have been 2.7%. So if that's what one would call skyrocketing, then we're on a different page.
Well, Joe, I'm really happy to hear that you've been keeping your rent affordable and that you've been taking care of your residents and making sure to not do, you know, huge charges. But there was a report back in March that showed that Rochester actually had the 10th highest increases in rent in the country. That's not the state. I'm talking about the whole country. We were up there with New Orleans. So it is, you know, we can't deny that there's a very real problem with rapidly increasing rent. And if we pass this policy with 485A, that's just going to continue. So we really need to pursue some new policies to make sure Rochester is affordable for everybody, and not just affordable, but people are living in really good conditions.
But Riddy, the mayor-elect, says he agrees with that critique in general, but that's why 485 got amended, and now he's more comfortable with it.
Right, but it's not true affordability. So like I mentioned already, that AMI is based on the county. That's much more than what's going on actually in the city. That 20% at 60% AMI is just not true affordability. And from what I'm understanding, it might not even be permanent affordability. I'm not clear on what the plan is to ensure that this is actually enforced and that what the timeline would be.
Yeah,
For example, with other policies that are similar to this, the affordability actually gets phased out over a period of time. So I want to be really clear that we want deep affordability. We want strong tenant protections. We want to make sure that there's policies in place to make sure that the rent, you know, maybe it's affordable 1 year and the next year it's 40% higher. That's a true thing that we've seen happen in some cases. So we want to make sure we have permanent affordability, that we have deep affordability, and also that there's real, genuine community input on this. So with this 45A policy, it's been really rushed this year, and our sense is that the mayor has been trying to push this through before she resigns in December. Usually this comes up for a vote in December or January. To our knowledge, there has been no community sessions where people are allowed to come in and talk about what this policy is, get educated and given their input. To our knowledge, there actually haven't even been any work sessions privately among city council members to discuss and get educated on this policy and its consequences or potential alternatives. So we really need to slow down if we're going to opt into policies like this. If we opt in now, it's going to last through 2024, and the tax breaks are going to last for 12 years. So we'll actually be feeling the impacts on this through 2036.
Matt,
I
want to hear if Matt Druin agrees with Riddy's critique that this is largely going to lead to development that favors rich white people, often suburban people who might move downtown, but usually rich white people, and it is not accessible for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at development, it's predominantly from white men that live out in the suburbs. How do you change that? I mean, I run a group where I actively look to curate black and brown and women-owned development companies to put the ladder down for them. And to think that there is this sea of people out there that want to do this if they only got the chance is, if you thought that existed, you'd be very, very misled. So our economy, our city, from an economic standpoint, is so depressed that we don't even have the actual group of people to actually lift up and support to have involved these projects. Because I do believe that development should be more racially and income diverse, but we just don't have the actual capacity. And that's what my focus is on building that capacity. And we do that through broadening the tax base. And we do that through programs like the quote unquote luxury housing tax break. Now, us at the Rochester Housing Coalition, I mean, we are supportive from the demand supply standpoint of expanding and increasing the Section 8 housing voucher program so that, you know, people shouldn't have to wait years to receive Section 8. And also their subsidies should be higher so that there can be competition and economic lift brought to development and providing affordable housing to our residents that need it the most.
All right, let me get phone calls. We've got a lot here. Let me start, and I'm just going to go down the list. If you're on the line, we're going to try to take you all of them here. Lisa in Rochester first. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. To the point of, community interaction and outreach and understanding among neighborhoods of what's being proposed, there hasn't been any. There's been no one's spoken to neighborhood organizations or neighborhood presidents about this. Though I'm really supportive of adaptive reuse and making good use of some really interesting factory buildings we've got around the city, the discussion of it that talks about it being downtown is pretty misleading in the sense that the zoning map for Center City has been expanded significantly. I don't think most people think of Center City as going all the way down Mount Hope Avenue to the Ford Street Bridge, or being most of the blocks, from Alexander and Comfort Street up to the point of the wedge. I think almost everybody has heard of, increasing property sales in the South Wedge, but the South Wedge is also become more than 70% rental in the last 15 years. So a whole bunch of, you know, moderate income people have been kind of squeezed out of, you know, owning and renting in the South Wedge. And I'm concerned that the way this is done could exacerbate that. If we're going to support affordable housing, I think the subsidy increases for affordable housing should come first before more luxury development, because if you're not going to contain it to the downtown and you're going to be affecting the rents in significant residential areas around downtown, as the Center City map would indicate, I think that risks further gentrifying our neighborhoods that, you know, are historically mixed income and diverse.
All right. Thank you, Lisa. Let me ask all three of our guests, and we'll kind of try to do it as tight as we can here because we got a lot of phone calls to get through. Joe Hanna is the owner of Hanna Properties and president of the Southeast Landlord Coalition. What do you make of that, Joe?
Well, that was a lot said, and I would agree with Lisa that I agree with her. I mean, there's so much that she said that I could take 15 minutes of comment. So you want to keep it tight. So
cosign. Joe says cosign on that. Riddy, how do you feel about Lisa's call?
I would also cosign. But thank you, Lisa, for giving that perspective from the neighborhood, showing just what the impact of city policy has been so far. So I think there are alternatives available, and we just need the political will and to work together to get to those. Thank you, Lisa.
Matt Druin is the partner. By the way, Riddy is communications coordinator with the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester. Matt Druin is partner at Oak Grove Development. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, I think we need more public discussion. I mean, I haven't had, I have to, really, really work hard to get the attention of people that are on city council and our state lawmakers. And I'm in the business of providing housing, and I have been for the past 15 years. And to not be called on to public sessions and public discussions to talk through these things, because there's only a certain amount we can do is spending time on a talk show. We can find actually a lot of common ground that we agree on, because at the end of the day, we all want to live in a city that actually looks the same, where we have universal prosperity across the board, regardless of what you look like and what you came from. That being said, I think affordable housing development definitely needs to be lightened up. I mean, the whole financial model with low-income housing tax credit developers is always focused on really, really large, huge projects because they're development fee driven. They're not cash flow driven like most real estate investors. So what can we do to use HCR and those programmings to create more affordable housing units that are on a smaller scale?
All right, Rich in Rochester, next on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Hi, how you doing, Evan?
Good, sir.
In listening to this discussion, there's a couple things that happened earlier that sort of bothered me. To compare Rochester to New York and what a luxury apartment in New York is or in San Francisco is sort of just tone deaf by your guest. I find that to be pretty tone deaf. And to also talk about $3,600 as not expensive in Rochester, and that goes to his point, well, you just have to raise the wages here. Reality is, we're in Western New York. These are the wages of New York, Western New York. And to make comparisons to New York City or any of the other larger, richer cities in the United States is really unfair. And I think just from my perspective, listening to your guest say that, he's lost. He doesn't get it.
All right, Rich.
I just find it.
Yeah. Thank you, Rich. So Matt, he says you got to be in the context of Rochester. Luxury here is not the same as luxury in New York City.
I mean, these apartments are, you can look at the pricing, and a $3,600 a month for a two-bedroom apartment that's definitely a luxury price. But for the product itself, I don't see it as a luxury product. So it bothers me when there's a name slapped on something it's just not true. And that's one unit that we're talking about here. And of course, let's just pick the most expensive apartment we can possibly find and use that to paint this whole story. And
sure. Okay. But what about $2,200 a month? What about $2,300, $2,400 a month? Is that luxury?
So a housing market study done in 2018 by the City of Rochester stated that an apartment, a one-bedroom apartment, has to be priced at $1,500 a month without subsidy in order for the project to even happen. So that's without subsidy. So we're dealing with cost of housing development versus incomes that are completely out of whack with each other. So my standpoint is let's focus on the income and economic empowerment picture. And until we can figure out an actual housing plan, I think that we need to keep this program in place. 2024 is not a long time. I look at 20 to 30 years in increments in terms of time frame. So I think that we can stick a pin in this, actually have a rigorous discussion around what we want to see housing policy to provide supply, and also focus on incomes.
Okay. Johanna, what do you think?
Well, as Matt knows, and I think you do too, Evan, the city is in the midst of having an outside consultant come in and has done a very extensive housing study in Rochester. I don't think any of the their findings have been made public. I've seen some of it, and there's some very important conclusions that they draw that are very relevant to what we're saying now, and I would suggest, if I may be so bold, that this program, once the study comes out and people have a chance to look at it, they're going to be surprised at some of the findings when it comes to what it is involved in to invest in property, what your return on investment should be, and other matters that are necessary to incentivize investors.
Okay, Riddhi Singh.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think, again, that we need to look at policies to ensure that we have, we stabilize rents. And then I just also want to add that, like, even the websites of some of these properties that have received the 45A, they are self-describing their properties as luxury. So, I mean, Matt, if you want to talk to Andy about, you know, his branding and whether or not he should be branding it as luxury apartment, you're welcome to do so. But, you know, that's what the Metropolitan is saying itself about their own apartments.
Let me get an email from a listener named Andrew who says, Evan, my wife and I drive around town and we see new construction of apartments everywhere. My wife would sarcastically say, luxury housing, just what we need. And I used to agree with her, meaning we don't need it. Lately, my thoughts have changed. As more housing units are built and open up, I feel there's a pressure to fill them and keep existing housing units full. That pressure may eventually cause rents to go down a little in order to keep occupancies up. Perhaps that pressure would get applied to all levels of housing, from high end to other levels, and might also put pressure on some landlords to keep their properties in better repair. That's from Andrew. Matt Druin, what do you make of that analysis?
Sounds like an economist.
You agree with that analysis?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. You know, supply orientation is where we need to be across the board in all housing unit production, because there's an enormous amount of lead lag time between when an idea pops in a developer's head as to this is, you know, I'm going to create this housing, or I'm going to turn this building into housing, to when it actually turns into a key in the door with a resident. So, and that process takes between 24 and 36 months. And we're always going to be behind the eight ball when it comes to housing unit production. Especially in the affordable side of things. So if we can increase supply through utilizing a diversity of programs, then we can start to cure these issues over time.
Riddhi Singh, what do you think?
Well, just we have to kind of separate out these markets a little bit. So I work at the tenant union, and we speak with like low-income tenants every day who are saying, I'm looking for housing, but I can't find it. I can't find housing that I afford. So those apart, it's almost like an entirely separate market. These apartments that are going up, there's like the supply for affordable and high quality housing stock is extremely low. So building up these high end housing, it's kind of almost a separate thing altogether. It's not really going to impact these people who are really, really struggling to find housing that suits their needs, is habitable, safe, and affordable for them.
What do you make, though, Riddhi, of Matt's repeated call this hour that we're diagnosing the problem the same, but his prescription's different. He's saying we've got to focus on wages, earnings, economic empowerment. We've got to get more people making more money so they can afford to live in units like this. What do you think?
Yeah, so there was this article by reporter Hamilton Nolan a few months ago, and what it talked about is that if we increase wages without also addressing skyrocketing rent, all of your wage gains are simply going to go into rent. So the wage gains you're supposedly getting, you're not really going to feel them, because this is actually what's already been happening over the last year. Any, you know, people, there's been reports of like wage gains in the economy, but rent has been skyrocketing at the same time. So you don't really get to even feel the impact of those wage gains if you are having to pay more rent every year. So we need to really address both at once: economic empowerment, improving the minimum wage, supporting, you know, labor unions and strong labor policy. But at the same time, we have to look into rent stabilization. We have to look into policies that really fight displacement, that help people keep people in their homes.
Johanna, what do you make of Andrew's email where he says, look, build more of these things, that'll drive the prices down and that'll make them more accessible?
Well, and I can only speak to the Southeast quadrant, sure. And I'm certainly have my finger on what's going on there. I have found that the balance between supply and demand isn't in good shape. We just talked about, I was complimented for keeping my rent increases at 2.7 over the last 2 years. Well, it also tells us another story, that the demand isn't there that would allow me to raise my rents at some of the levels that the tenants union rep has suggested. So I don't see these tremendous rises in rent, and most of what I hear is anecdotal, not statistical.
Let me get back to the phones and Roberta in Brighton. Hi, Roberta.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
No one has mentioned the aesthetic, the aesthetics or the lack of aesthetics behind these mushrooming developments. You know, we talk about the rents. You know, $3,600 a month for a two-bedroom apartment that is nothing more than a series of boxes, and that there's no supermarket in the area that you can walk to. I don't understand it. I mean, we've just ripped down a few years ago, the on Mount Hope, those brutalist architecture, the high-rise concrete things, and now we're just putting in these things that look like, you know, they just look like really shoddy motels and hotels from this time period. I mean, who wants to walk around and look at this kind of repetition? I just don't get it. And again, I think that somebody like Riddhi Singh is just doing a fabulous job, and I'd love to see her become more involved with City Council. And I love the idea of opening this thing up to, you know, conversations about the neighborhoods, the people that are actually living in these places, as opposed to the developers who are not living in the area and are really not committed to representation of different people and different incomes and different backgrounds.
Yeah, let me let Riddhi jump in there. Riddhi, you're going to run for City Council.
No, not anytime soon, I hope, but I appreciate the vote of confidence. Roberta, I think you're right on the money. People in neighborhoods, the developments you're talking about wouldn't receive these specific tax breaks because they're for conversions. You're definitely right. You know, you're understanding that people in these communities aren't having an input on the way these developments happen. They're not having input on the aesthetic changes of, you know, that they're like literally their neighborhood looks different as a result of these changes, and they don't have an opportunity. So, you know, we really want to encourage the city to have housing policies that have real, not just community input, but long-term community control. It's not just a survey. It's not just like a focus group. It's not a meeting that was extremely poorly advertised where, you know, they check off the box and they said community input. We want members of the community to be real decision makers in the way these things happen alongside experts. You know, we want to see folks who are houseless. We want to see tenants. We want to see homeowners, and then, you know, mix it up with some, you know, academics or developers, just have like real genuine community input and real genuine community control. We're not making decisions just on what's going to be most profitable for people who don't even live in our community.
All right. Bob in Rochester, by the way, Matt Druin, I'm not going to have a chance to take his call, but he wanted to say he thinks if you need a tax break up front, it's corporate welfare. We shouldn't do that. If you can't do the project out of your own pocket, you shouldn't do it. What would you say to Bob?
We shouldn't have stoplights either. I mean, so, I mean, this is a, you know,
a stoplight's not an apartment complex.
Yeah. The thing is that we've understood that this development's incredibly risky, development's incredibly expensive, and these are the policies that have worked to create housing downtown, and without it, there would be no housing downtown. And then therefore, my rents wouldn't have gone to lower income people that, you know, have normally been blocked out of the neighborhoods that I serve. So I think that, I don't like giving tax breaks to developers, but, you know, at the end of the day, this is what has worked. And until we can figure out something else, I think that we need to keep these programs in place.
All right. And final word from Joe Hanna as City Council considers this for tomorrow. Final thoughts from you on the vote tomorrow at Council on 485A, Joe.
Well, you're putting me on the spot, but I would say I'm speaking for myself, not for my group.
Yeah.
I would support the City Council resolution. I think their housing downtown is good for the whole community. We need a vital, vibrant downtown as long as there's an affordable component.
That is part of what Mayor-elect Evans says has been at the core of the debate. That's also what Riddhi Singh says. It's kind of a red herring that this is not necessarily what it looks like it is with that title, but we're going to see what City Council does tomorrow. Joe, owner of Hanna Properties, thanks for being with us, Joe.
Thank you for inviting me.
Riddhi Singh, with the Citywide Tenant Union of Rochester. Thank you, Riddhi.
Thank you so much.
And Matt Druin, partner at Oak Grove Development. Thanks for making it in here.
Yes, thank you, and everything your team does.
We appreciate you, and we appreciate all the listeners of Connections, the whole team saying thanks. Rob Braden, Emery Stein, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson saying thank you, and we will talk to you tomorrow on member-supported Public Radio.